As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Andy Staples Show. It is our season in review edition, and there's a gentleman that you haven't heard from in about a week. I guess you heard from him on Monday, but you need to hear from him again because he has not gotten a chance to say his piece since he stuck to his guns in one way, turned his back on a promise he made in another way. But at the end of the day, Ari Wasserman was correct and I was wrong. Ari, Georgia, your national champion, as you predicted in the preseason, as you flipped on your pledge to never bet against Nick Saban and bet against Nick Saban, you were right. Georgia beat Alabama. Ari, the floor is yours.
I'm supposed to take off my shirt and run around the room now?
We're doing this on video, so yes, absolutely.
Yes,
we need some VOD content.
I was actually listening to the podcast that you did with Dave Ubben after the game, and I was just like, it kind of hit me. I'm just disappointed that you didn't stick with it, man, because you had the perfect.
Because I actually got the whole scenario right.
Yeah, it's like easy to say.
If you read what I wrote, I did mention JT Daniels would play a big part in that. So I don't think I got it exactly right. But no, I don't regret saying that I'll never bet against Nick Saban again. I feel like that is a pretty sound way to think. But it was wrong here, and for the reasons that you and I discussed quite a bit. In fact, you know, I wrote a couple things in the lead up to the game saying, here's how Georgia can win, and here's what they didn't do the first time, what they could do the second time. And they did that stuff. They did a bunch of different stuff, and you know, the pressure on Bryce Young was obvious. Jameson Williams getting hurt certainly didn't help, mm-hmm. but I don't know that necessarily beat Alabama. I don't think that was the game, you know, game over when he got hurt. Alabama still could have won the game. In fact, was in great position to win the game in the fourth quarter. But
here's the way that I view it, though, Andy. I thought Alabama kicked Georgia's butt for 3.5 quarters. Like, I know that everybody, like, and Georgia's defense had great red zone D, and that's what won them the game ultimately. But it felt like Alabama was in control of the game until after the fumble. And, you know, even though Georgia ended up winning the game, I don't think it's this start to finish Georgia triumph that everybody's making it out to be. You know what I mean? And it doesn't matter what happened the entire game. All that matters is at the end, and I'm not taking anything away from Georgia. But like, if you bet Georgia -3, you were not comfortable in that game until the pick six, right? So like, you're in a moment where, you know, Alabama, in what was probably a down year for Alabama standards, was a half a quarter away from winning the national championship. So, you know, the thing that was, I kind of feel like a villain here from like a Marvel movie, because everybody wanted new blood to win it. Everybody would have liked to see Michigan or Cincinnati do the unthinkable and make the playoff entertaining and have a different result. I came into the national championship game golden. Like, whoever, it was the number one versus number two team in the composite rankings. I wasn't going to get inundated with a bunch of number 41 team
new
in the country.
Blood did win it. I mean,
and that's what
Michigan
I was going to say.
Won a national title more recently than Georgia had.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, of the best case scenarios for somebody in my of my viewpoint, which is talent is the thing that trumps everything, but also somebody who is like the average fan who would like to see different results. So we're not talking about the same four teams every year on this podcast. Georgia has been viewed as a team that's at the cool kids table, like we've talked about, but they actually won it for the first time in over 40 years. So even though they're winning recruiting crowns and playing in big games and SEC championship games, it still was a different result. So I think it's really, really cool. Like, I don't know if I want to sit back and be like, I told you so. Georgia was going to win it from start to finish. All I did was pick the most talented team in college football and a team that I thought was going to be in a position schedule-wise to get there, because their path was the yellow brick road to the national championship game. You know, I don't feel like I'm some sort of genius. And at the end of the day, too, I also wasn't feeling confident about Georgia going into the game. Like, I thought Alabama was going to win before. I just didn't want to flop because we made it so far. I was four quarters away from being right, so why not stick with it? That said, watching that game from start to finish, it was a complete showcase of what ultra talented teams playing at a high level looks like. And, you know, both teams couldn't block each other. You had talent oozing in the secondaries. You know, the quarterback position on one side was super talented. The other one stepped up when it mattered the most and won. I mean, I thought, you know, and there were some key players missing. You know, I thought that was a good showcase for the two best teams in the sport and the best team in the sport that we were talking about all year, and the unit that we were talking about all year prevailed. And I find that to be kind of satisfying because, you know, I don't know if you're with me on this, Andy, and I love watching March Madness as much as everybody else. I think my bachelor party is going to be in Vegas for March Madness this year. But the thing about the college basketball championship is not satisfying to me because I sometimes don't believe that the best team wins it because it's so crazy. Like, to me,
it's a single elimination tournament. It's basketball. So one great player can win a whole game. Yeah.
And like in college football, when the best team in the country from start to finish wins it all, I find that to be satisfying, especially in a sport where we spent 50 years, not 100% knowing who to crown. So like, to me, I thought this is a wonderful year. Talent prevails like it always does. It will continue next year and into the foreseeable future, as long as the recruiting rankings look the way that they do. But I don't think that I'm some sort of genius. I just think I'm somebody who only, you know, was able to pull up the 247 composite talent rankings and use his head based on schedules and paths.
I think you're a genius, Ari. I'm going to go with that. Yeah. I'm going to throw that genius label on you.
Everybody wants to gloat, but it's like, I don't even feel like it's like, was it that profound of a take? Like, go back and look at the preseason.
It wasn't, but there was a segment of people, and they're very short-sighted people, who just could not believe, either because Georgia hadn't won since 1980, which, again,
makes
that
no
didn't
sense.
Matter.
Yeah.
They were very talented. Who cares when the last time they won was? And they believe Kirby Smart could not overcome Nick Saban. And you and I have repeatedly said on this show over the last couple of years, if you build that kind of talent base, you will keep getting bites of the apple, and eventually you will win. You will break through. And that's what happened. And would it surprise me at all if this is the first of several or the first of many for Kirby Smart's Georgia? No, it would not.
No, it seems like that's what it is. I mean, I don't know. Bill Landis and I, and maybe we'll get some other people involved in this, are working on this story right now, very in early stages. But after the national championship, we always like to look at like preseason way too early rankings for the following year. But you know what doesn't exist? Yeah. And maybe we can make this into the audio form too. A program rankings list. Like, where would you rank the programs from start to finish? Because that doesn't always fluctuate based on who wins the most recent national championship. So like, if I were to rank the programs right now, I would still rank Alabama number one.
Let's do it.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do it. And if we were to do it like in a story form, we'd probably take math into consideration, like giving a certain amount of points, a certain amount of points for national championship, a certain amount of points for playoff berth, a certain amount of points for 10 win seasons, recruiting classes, and all those things. But off the top of the cuff, the results will be different because of how we view it. But like, I think Alabama is unquestionably the number one program in America still. And then number two would be Georgia, because they won the most recent national championship and they've been recruiting at a high level to sustain that success. And then when you start getting into three is when it gets difficult.
Well, with Georgia, we have not seen them completely reload a year after they had a great year. Like, 2018 probably should have beaten Alabama for the SEC title. I'm not sure they would have been able to beat Clemson if they'd played them. 2019, you know, that was a down year for them. And then 2020, they didn't even win the East. So, like, we need to see them reload and be able to stay on that level. That's how you get to compete with Alabama for number one. There is no question that Alabama is number one, because we know Alabama will be in the mix next year for the national title. Will they win it? We don't know. Will they win the SEC? We don't know that.
I think we could basically just say we know they'll be in the playoff. Yeah, right. And like, I want to do it as a forward thinking thing, because you can go back mm-hmm. and say, and this is why number three gets tricky, because I think there's only two answers for number three, and that would be Clemson or Ohio State, right? And if you pick right. one of those two teams, how much do you weight Clemson's championships? Because they've won two titles more recently than Ohio State has, and Ohio State only has one since 14. But if you're looking at which team is more situated to compete at a high level moving forward, you might pick Ohio State. So this is where things get a little bit dicey.
If it's forward-looking, I'm going to go with Ohio State, because they've recruited at that level. They've actually, and according to the rankings, recruited at a higher level than Clemson. They have a quarterback right now that you would feel very confident could lead a team to a national title. Like, I feel very confident in thinking that CJ Stroud could be a national championship leading quarterback. So I don't feel as confident about DJ Uiagalelei. Now, it might be that Cade Klubnik comes in and you feel completely different. And that changes how you
starting
feel about Clemson.
Week three.
But as we sit here, I would put Ohio State at three.
Okay, so if we put Ohio State at three, then Clemson automatically slides into four.
Yes. Now, who's next?
That's because the thing that gets tricky.
This is where Oklahoma would have been, probably, but we don't know because they're in flux. Caleb, I was assuming when Caleb Williams announced that he was going to transfer, that he was going to enter the transfer portal. I should be very careful as I say that. He didn't announce he was going to transfer. He still conceivably could go back to Oklahoma. And if you looked at Dylan Gabriel's announcement about betting on himself, he did say he was going to Oklahoma with no guarantee that Caleb Williams was gone. So I don't know where Caleb Williams lands. I'm assuming it's not Oklahoma, but I don't know where it's going to be. So with Oklahoma, I guess we evaluate them with Dylan Gabriel being their quarterback and Jeff Lebby running the offense. We've seen those two work together before with success, but you know, I don't know where they're at depth chart wise after losing some pretty good players. And you know, Brent Venables is just,
but you also have to take into account who the head coach of these programs are.
It's absolutely. Like, I think like, we don't know Brent Venables as a head coach yet.
And this is what makes it really, really difficult, because you can take data points and results from previous seasons, the last 5 years, and you could say Oklahoma clearly outdoes USC in all those metrics. 10-win seasons, playoff berths, conference championships, all of it. But at the same time, it's like if you want to pick what program you would go with moving forward, I might be more prone to pick USC as a team that's more likely to win a national championship in the next 5 years than Oklahoma would.
We'll be right back after these words.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let me throw two at you. And I have a feeling you'd put both of these in your 6 through 10. But two as a potential nominee for number 5. Brian Kelly's old school and Brian Kelly's new school.
Yeah, I mean they're all in that mix, you know. I think I would put LSU ahead of Notre Dame just based on the talent that's available to LSU, the area of the country.
See, I would put Notre Dame ahead of LSU right now, because Notre Dame has been more consistent. Brian Kelly's got to prove that he can make LSU consistent before I feel confident making the mean hire. But you're right. He will inherit a ton of talent.
Because that's where the lack of uniformity comes into play, though, here, right?
Yeah. I mean, Notre Dame's an interesting one because if Notre Dame had an established elite quarterback coming back, I'd feel very comfortable sliding them in there at number five. Like, I think Marcus Freeman's going to do fine there. I think he's going to recruit very well. He may even recruit better than his predecessor. He certainly, so far, seems like he can do that. And then, you know, it's just that I'm not sure where they stand at that position. LSU, they're also not established at that position, and they've been wildly inconsistent. So that's why I would still have Notre Dame above LSU there.
Yeah, but what's tricky that here, Andy, has, is I think you have to
a
like,
lot of talent.
Think about it a tad deeper than that, though. It's not which teams are most situated to be really, really good in 2022. It's which programs have a foundation and are sustainable for long-term success. And that doesn't, I'm not saying that Notre Dame and LSU isn't a good debate.
Notre Dame's foundation is better than LSU's right now.
Then I think you could make that argument and put them in at number five, regardless of who the quarterback is in either of the programs.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know who. I would put Notre Dame at number five right now, and then LSU or Oklahoma somewhere in that 6 to 10 range. Who else falls into the 6 to 10 range?
Well, is what's interesting, I'm wondering, is where do you put Michigan now?
That's what I was going to ask you. Where do we put Michigan? Where do we put Penn State? Where do we put Wisconsin? Where do we put? Well, Florida just fired their coach. You know, if this were last year and Florida was coming off those three seasons, we'd put them much higher. That's the part I'm trying to figure out. It gets really murky really fast once you get past those five or six.
Yeah, and it's like when you start talking about Penn State, Michigan,
A&M.
A&M is the biggest one. Like, I think I would put A&M in the top five. Like, I'd probably put A&M ahead of LSU and Notre Dame. Because of what they just did.
I don't know that I put them ahead of Notre Dame right now just because they haven't really gotten over the hump. But once they get over the hump, you would have put them in the top five every year.
But what do you think is the more important hump? Recruiting like Alabama or making the playoff 2 years ago?
Making the playoff.
Because you think that making it in the past is more valuable than what can happen next?
Having made it matter. And the thing is, Notre Dame has had to go undefeated to make it. They've made it in a league. Like, I'm sorry that... I'm going to put them ahead until A&M proves it can do it.
But if somebody put a gun to your head right now and said, which team are you buying stock in for the next 5 years? Which one are you taking? That's the point of this. Ooh. One has a new, bright, young coach that is expected to do big things. But here's another thing that I'm going to veer this off of. When it comes to... Like, we could be on this. We joked before this podcast started, everyone, that we have to be out in 2 hours. And Andy said he'd be divorced if he's in. I'm going to drag you into the pits of hell for 3 hours if you really want to go down this road.
Okay, but, now we got to figure out where Michigan State's going to be if you're going to drag me into the deep end.
Yeah, but like, here's the thing that,
into
that
the deep water.
Is very interesting to me. And this isn't just a where do the programs stand conversation, but of all the programs in college football, because we didn't even mention Oregon, and this is an Oregon discussion too.
Oregon needs to be in this discussion.
Which teams in college football are most reliant on a national recruiting strategy? The two powers that come to mind, obviously, are Notre Dame and Oregon. Because all the other teams that recruit nationally also have a solid foundation. Ohio State has a foundation. Ohio, LSU, Louisiana, Texas, and Texas A&M have Texas. Florida goes without saying. I don't need to go down the list.
Georgia has
the best possible scenario at home. But no matter what Oregon and Notre Dame do, Andy, they have to be successful nationally. And if you look across from coast to coast.
They have to work harder. You're right. They absolutely have to work harder than everybody else.
And if you look across the country, and this is... This pertains to the discussion of where would you put these programs on the list of program rankings. There isn't a pocket of the country with a ton of talent that has a ton of outward weakness at the head coaching position from the nearby powerhouse. Like, Lincoln Riley at USC makes recruiting Southern California harder. Sark and Jimbo Fisher in Texas make recruiting Texas harder. Not that it wasn't already hard, but the Houston area, the way that A&M has had it under control – that's harder. You go well, on and, to Florida.
And Venables at Oklahoma, too, because let's be honest, Oklahoma is always going to get a lot of its best players from Texas, has historically always done that. And so you have to look at Brent Venables being there as someone who is going to take some of the best of Texas every year.
Yeah, and if you take Texas off the board, and I don't think that Notre Dame was particularly huge in Texas, but they're down in Texas. Then you go into Florida. You've got Billy Napier, who's already shown more recruiting chops than Dan Mullen did in 2 months. And you have Mario Cristobal, who was unquestionably one of the best recruiters in the country in South Florida. You go into Georgia, where when Mark Richt was the head coach at Georgia, it was a little bit easier to get guys out of that state. It's a lot harder now. And everybody and their brother is in Atlanta. There aren't a lot of pockets where densely populated talent areas with liabilities at head coaches at the programs that should be recruiting them the best. So for a recruiting standpoint, I look at Notre Dame and I say, well, they've been a very, very consistent team. Brian Kelly, you could make an argument, squeezed every bit of potential he could have out of there. But if I'm looking at Notre Dame's recruiting strategy right now, which is a lot of California and a lot of national reliance, I'm thinking to myself, well, where do I go? Like, it's going to be in a world where Marcus Freeman, and this is actually probably a really good story for Pete Sampson if he'd want to do it, but in a world where Marcus Freeman is going to be expected to increase the output of their recruiting results, he's also coming in at a time where it's probably it's hardest in the last 5-10 years from a good recruiting coach standpoint from a national perspective. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. And it is, but I do think they've got a pretty good foundation so that when they come in, they can say, look, we went undefeated in the regular season, made the playoff in 2018. We were in a league in 2020. And we made the playoff. We made the championship game. And so I do think they can come in and fight those schools. They have a pretty good education to sell. I know that doesn't always matter, but
the automatic in at Catholic private schools too.
Yeah. They get guys into the NFL too. Like Harry Hiestand's back coaching the offensive line there. How many great offensive linemen, first round offensive linemen, did Harry Hiestand recruit and help develop? Like, That's the thing you got to think about. So,
but it's just going to be harder. So if you have a program that's in the top five in your program rankings, you have to take into account, can they continue to recruit at a level that is necessary to get the results that would indicate a top five program? And it's like right now, if I had to choose between A&M and Notre Dame, I would pick the coach that's won a national championship already and just sign the best class of all time at a place that has all the money in the world during the NIL era and a passionate fan base and plays in a, and you know, they haven't done it yet. And I understand that, but
you basically described Georgia during the earlier Kirby Smart period.
And I would have picked Georgia in the top five 4 years ago or 3 years ago.
Yeah, I would have.
The second that Georgia signed a top class and beat Alabama for that distinction, you knew Kirby was going to get it eventually. You can go find bylines of mine from 4 years ago that say they're going to win eventually.
And that's what's interesting too. So what you're saying, and I'm inclined to agree with you here, is that if Jimbo Fisher keeps doing this, it will be just like Kirby Smart, where they will just keep chipping and chipping, and eventually it will break through.
If they sign four classes in a row that are like this one, they will be built like Georgia. And I'm not saying they're automatically going to win and beat Alabama and do all the things that they need to do in order to get there, but if you're built like Georgia, you have a chance. Now, obviously, A&M has a disadvantage in the sense that they have to play Bama during the regular season every single year and win that side of the conference, which is a lot harder than what Georgia had to do in order to get there. And they did beat them this year. So, you know, we don't know what Alabama is going to look like in 4 or 5 years. And that is probably going to be the sweet spot of when A&M arrives, because everybody at Texas A&M right now is probably, you know, dancing in the streets of, we're going to finally get this done. Look at this class. I think people need to realize it takes more than one class. I don't care how good your class is. If you want to be built like Bama, it takes 4 years. So if they can do this over a 4 year period, which I have every reason to believe in my heart that they can, then by 2026, when we're talking about the playoff, I bet anything that they're going to be in that discussion. And I don't know that I would bet anything that Notre Dame would be. And I think I might have successfully changed your mind.
If we're talking about who has a chance to win the national title sooner, I think I agree with you on A&M. if we're talking about just a level of consistency, if you're looking for a program that's going to get you to the NFL, that is going to be very successful while you're there, Notre Dame's been more consistent so far. But no,
without question.
I think
when you start making rankings of which programs are the best, but you have different criteria, like you're going past and future, like of course some people's pasts are going to be better than some people's futures. And like when you start ranking them in the same list using both sides, it can become inconsistent. It was kind of like the playoff rankings this year. But like,
well, and I'm doing this as more the past being somewhat predictive of the future. And that's the thing with A&M. And here's the thing about A&M that we've both done our verbal crutches today. I don't know if you noticed, we had a discussion about that on Twitter the other day. I say here's the thing too much, and you say in a world too much.
Oh,
that's
wow.
What the listeners have told us.
Yeah, I do mm-hmm. say in a world too much. That's right.
And I say here's the thing way too much. So here's the thing. The talk about Texas A&M and whether Texas A&M can win a national title, because Texas A&M has had all these resources, has had all these advantages, has had everything you should need to win a national title, and yet some, for some reason could never do it, is no different than saying Georgia can't win a national title because they haven't won one since 1980.
Okay, if we're playing chess, I'm about to move my queen into a check position here. It's the same.
We're agreeing here.
No, I know, but I'm also going to bring something else.
It's the same argument.
But I'm also going to bring something else into this.
Okay.
Texas. If you think that what they couldn't do for the last 40 years is an indication. Listen, I'm on the same side of you as Texas. But like, if anybody has any question about what I'm going to view Texas A&M in the context of what they just did in the recruiting realm, it's so freaking predictable. I punted on Texas. I'm out. I'm with you. I'm out. But of course I feel the same way about A&M now.
I thought you were coming back.
But of course I feel back. The same way about A&M now. A&M did the thing that Texas had already been doing. Now, if in 6 years A&M still stinks, then we'll have to have a discussion about what's going on in College Station that's preventing them from getting over the top the same way that we've beaten a dead horse over Texas with. But like, Texas A&M in my mind is the king of Texas recruiting right now in a very prestigious conference with a coach who's won a national championship and has more talent on their roster coming in than any other team in college football. It's like, of course I'm going to agree with that or believe in that.
Okay. Well, that and that answers one of the common questions I get is who's the next first? Like, who's the next first-time playoff participant? Who's the next first-time national champion? Well, first time since, because obviously A&M won in 1939, so they got that going for them. But
I think
first modern era national title, I guess.
I think picking the next newcomer to win the national title is a lot easier than picking who's the next playoff crasher.
Well, A&M could be the next playoff crasher.
Yeah, but
he's got to win. Let's say they won the West next year, but I don't think they will. I'm gonna go into the season thinking Alabama's gonna win the West. But if they can win the West, they can make the playoff.
Yeah, I mean the problem with A&M is that they will never have the ability or the chance that Georgia had to lose to Alabama in the regular season and then get a chance to beat them again in the playoff. Because like, most likely, unless you think that the playoff, it's just a lot harder to get in as a non-conference champion game participant, right? So,
well, it could happen. It would be the same thing as Alabama getting in 2017.
Yeah, and lost to Auburn. It's just a lot harder than like Georgia's path to the national championship game this year was the easiest possible path an SEC team will ever have. Like, you miss Alabama in the regular season. You have LSU. They played LSU, right, when they were down. Like, they didn't mm-hmm. really have that marquee matchup until they played Alabama in the national championship, or I mean, in the SEC championship game. They got
didn't play LSU at all. They played Auburn and
oh, yeah, they missed LSU.
Out of the West.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, their entire schedule was facing middle-tier SEC teams that are still very good. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's never going to be easier than what they got.
It's much easier than somebody trying to come out of the West.
Yeah, and they also got their butts kicked in the most important game of the year for them leading into the playoff, and were still granted access to the playoff, which if you're doing that in the same division, which A&M found out 2 years ago during a shortened season, when you lose by 28 points to an in-division rival, the chances of making the playoff from that aspect is much harder than getting in Georgia's situation. Because, like, honestly speaking, any other year, like, honestly, what if Ohio State was undefeated this year? Like, there's a realm of possibility where if this was a regular year and Clemson and Ohio State were both really good, that Georgia wouldn't even made the playoff at all.
Now, Georgia would have had another loss if Clemson were undefeated just because
that's right. But this year. You get what I'm saying. If there was another, two other 100%. Undefeated Power 5 champs or one lost Power 5 champs, like if Ohio State would have beaten Michigan and won the Big Ten championship, that would have taken a spot away from Cincinnati. And if Clemson would have run the table, that would have been a very interesting situation because they lost in the opener. I'm just saying, in a world where, God, I got to stop saying in a world now. It's in my head. It's like in a world. It's like a trailer in a world. But as we look back at all the other playoff fields, most of the time there's four bona fide, legit Power 5 champions ready to take the field. And this year, for Cincinnati to get in, that just means that there was nobody else to put in over Georgia. But Georgia's lucky enough that this happened in a year where they were still able to get in.
Yeah.
And it's a reminder of how many good teams in the past didn't make the playoff who were probably good enough to win the national championship.
Well, and that's, I mean, you've had that with Georgia. Like the 2007 Georgia team might have been the best team in the country at the end of the season, but they had two earlier losses and they were out. So they wound up playing Hawaii in the Sugar Bowl. And I would have loved to have seen 2012 Texas A&M in the playoff. I think that would have been a heck of a lot of fun watching Johnny Football as they got into like chipper shredder mode. So I would have enjoyed that.
Remember two years ago during the pandemic, Andy, when everybody in College Station wanted me out of media and wanted to burn my house down because I said that you can't get into the playoff if you lose the one game you can't lose by 28 points to your rival. Now I'm like Texas A&M's biggest fan, and I think they like me again because of what they did in the recruiting realm. But now Georgia won a national championship in a year later after I said that losing to your rival or in the game that you can't lose by 28 is a prerequisite to getting out. Georgia was in a situation where they were still able to get in. So I think they're very lucky to have been given the path to play Alabama again, and what obviously resulted in the most cathartic possible win in the history of Georgia football.
I am 100% in agreement with you. I think this was a different year, and I don't know if it was because there were teams that had a lot more experience than they would have had because of the extra year because of COVID, or because they felt like they didn't really get to show themselves in 2020, so they came back and didn't go to the NFL. But this felt like a very different season. Now, at the end, there were still kind of two elite teams, and Alabama and Georgia looked like they were playing a different sport than everyone else. But as you go down the rest of the way, it felt like a much more equitable season, if that makes sense. And I'm wondering, Ari, do you think that continues as long as those people who got the extra year are still working their way through the system?
Do you think that is the reason why it was what it was? Like, is that the explanation for why there was more parity this year than any other year, was because most of these teams had 22-year-olds playing on their offensive line when they wouldn't have otherwise?
Yes, I do. I do because, like, Oklahoma State, I feel like, is a prime example of this. Their defense was fantastic. Their defense was old. Their defense was super old. And I think that's the reason they won the Big 12, the reason they were so good all season. And the thing is, though, I think they can probably stay old. I don't know that they particularly can stay as old, because they had some guys that were, fifth and sixth type, last one. This is super senior. You got to go after this. But are there going to be guys who would have been a fourth year senior playing this year, who would have been leaving, who will be back next year, who will continue to keep those teams old? It's the college basketball thing. Get old, stay old if you're a mid-major.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about the NFL, though, is that it's calling, and if you're good enough to go, then you go regardless of what, you know, your circumstance is. But at the same time, too, there are a lot of very old players in relation to what they have in college that aren't NFL players, but also very good football players at the college level that are just older. So, like, it would be a very interesting case study to go back and look. Like, if you want to come out and say, well, which team is going to be the one that crashes the playoff next year out of nowhere? It's like, well, the path to finding that is probably which team has the most fifth or sixth year seniors on their roster next year.
Yeah, who has the most 22 and 23 year olds? And, you know, who knew BYU had it right all along?
Like, yeah.
they had it figured out. We'll be right back after this message from one of our lovely sponsors. Let's talk about this season. What were some of your favorite teams this season? Like, who'd you just love watching?
Wake Forest.
Oh, yeah. They were a lot of Sam Hartman. They were old. They were really old on defense. Like, Jeff Masterson should have been gone. Like, I remember talking to those guys. He was in Florida, like, planning his wedding. Wasn't sure if he was going to come back or not. And they're like, dude, please come back. We could have a special team. And Fox, the D lineman, he was in his sixth season. He came back because he was just like, I love these guys. And I want to be around them another year. And I mean, that was a very special year for them. They win the division. And I got to say, their game against Army, the least defense I've ever seen played in a football game. It was amazing.
Yeah. They were definitely the team that I enjoyed watching the most just because of everything that you were seeing. Like, it was obviously offense and scoring and scoring and scoring, which we all love. Though I will say that I thought that the first half of the national championship game was tremendous. And if you hated it or you were acting like it wasn't entertaining or that neither team was very good, then I don't feel like you know much about the way the sport looks when both teams are very good. Like, I thought that was super awesome. That said, nothing is better than offense and scoring, and that's what we all like. And they had the story. They had the heartwarming story behind it. They had a window into potentially winning the ACC because Clemson was down this year. And, you know, it was just a very fun ride. And it's unfortunate that our sport is set up in a way where a team like Wake Forest, the way they were this past season, could never win a national championship. But it also doesn't mean it wasn't very fun. And I'm, like, looking back and trying to, like, remember, there were a lot of really, really good individual games this year.
Well, and I think Pitt was one of the more fun teams. And for the reason that we always make fun of them for on this show, like, their games are nuts. Like, that North Carolina game in the rain and overtime was crazy.
The fake slide is one of the best moments of the season.
Yes.
Kenny Pickett's swag.
Yeah.
So, like,
the fake slide
you keep going
quickly
back
made
the
illegal
trap.
For reasons we understand that, you know, if you actually are going to slide and, like, if Kenny Pickett were faking that slide and somebody had hit him, they would have run out of flags to throw. So we get why they made it illegal, but it was still cool when it happened. The two coolest plays to me were the fake slide and then Caleb Williams stealing the ball back from the back against Kansas to keep going, which I think also might have not been legal, depending on how I can't. Yeah. There was something that people were complaining about after that play. But the fact that he even thought of it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I am kind of surprised that Kenny Pickett was the first person to ever attempt that. Like, when you think about how long the slide has been in and how afraid everybody is to hit a quarterback. It honestly, though, it was super athletic. Like, it's not very hard to do it the way that he did
broken,
it. I would have thrown my back out. Would have slipped
everything.
The disc.
Thrown my back out, torn every ligament and tendon in both my legs. Like, it would have been horrendous.
Yeah, like, he was all the way back. His feet were forward, and then he just took off. It was incredible.
It hurt to watch.
Yeah.
It really did. But you're right. I do wonder why it took so long. I remember I was a teenager when Dan Marino did the fake spike against the Jets to win the game.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking when that happened, like, how come nobody ever does this?
It's true. So games, you want to talk about games?
Yeah.
Because I think the best game of the season, this is going to be a debate. The best game of the season to me was the Oklahoma-Texas game. It was the Red River.
Yes. Oh, I mean, because Texas...
It broke my heart.
Xavier Worthy takes the first play from scrimmage to the house, Texas dominates for a half. The true freshman quarterback gets put in for Oklahoma. Looks like, and remember, he had not played football in a year and a half when that happened. And he looked like he'd been doing it forever.
Was that the game of the year?
It was amazing.
Because you had the
it's
drama.
Close.
It wasn't just the way the game played out. You also had the drama of Spencer Rattler eating bench.
If Texas had been good the rest of the season, it would be better. The problem is Texas being bad the rest of the season. And maybe that game crushed Texas. I don't know. But them being bad the rest of the season takes a little shine off of it.
The thing that I consider when we're talking about best games is, what were we all feeling? What was our entertainment level in the moment? And I think everybody who loves college football who was watching that game was level 10 entertained during that entire game. But another one, too, was the A&M Alabama game. You got to give A&M some props there.
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous game.
Absolutely, because A&M controlled most of that game. Alabama storms back, and you are sure once Alabama takes the lead that there is no way A&M's going to win that game. But sure enough.
I got another one. You want to hear the other ones?
I'm ready.
Oklahoma State and Notre Dame in the bowl game.
That was awesome. That was a great Fiesta Bowl.
The best Fiesta Bowl we've seen in quite some time. And I don't think there will ever be a better Fiesta Bowl than the Statue of Liberty one. But that was, I thought, that was a very entertaining game.
You know what game entertained me in a kind of sicko way?
Which one?
Illinois over Penn State in 9 overtimes.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a good one. I mean, that's a moment.
It was amazing.
Yeah. The 2-point conversion rule, the shootout rule in college football is, I really like it. I don't know about you. I think it sucks. Like, especially if it were to determine a game where the playoff was on the line.
I don't like it, but I do understand it provides drama. Like, there was some Maximus echoing in my head after watching that game. Are you not entertained? I was highly entertained. And I was more entertained by the fact that Illinois could not throw the ball at all. And they bring in Peters right at the end and throw it.
You know another one?
Tad.
Another one? Yeah. Michigan State, Michigan. Tremendous football game.
Oh, that actually, now that I think about it, I'm gonna take back what I said about Texas, Oklahoma. Michigan State, Michigan, and you and I watched most of that together. We did a live stream for that game. That was the best game of the year because now we all know how I feel that I think Michigan got jobbed on that call that they should have gotten a touchdown on the Ajabo strip sack because it looked like he was laying on top of Ajabo when he was being sacked. But the fact that Michigan appeared to take control so many times and then Michigan State just kept coming, like that was an awesome game.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact of the matter was, is you got to go back in time and put yourself in the position that you were in. And that was Michigan needing a huge top 10 win for the first time and Harbaugh not getting it done. And you were just like, oh my God, it's happening again. And then the way that the season played out, it makes you go back and respect what Michigan State did that day and what Kenneth Walker did and what a transfer can do. Mm-hmm. And like that might have been the game that got Mel Tucker $95 million.
It very well might. By the way, Mel Tucker, the guest on Monday's show. So you can hear all about it.
Can you ask him about his $95 million?
I didn't ask him for a loan, no. Should I have asked him for a couple bucks?
I just want to be like, what are you gonna do, man? Like I would honestly.
We did talk a little bit about something you can spend a lot of money on that he had an idea that he threatened his players with. That he could actually probably afford to do now, but I can hear about that on Monday.
I would love to sit down in a room with Mel Tucker, just one-on-one, no recording devices, nothing, and just go, why are you even, like, what are you going to, like, just go through the next 4 or 5 years. It'll be better if you got fired because it's all guaranteed, and then just go live like Jordan Belfort. Like, you're good. You know what I mean? Like, you're good.
Turning Mel Tucker into the Wolf of Wall Street? Good Lord.
I mean, I don't know about you. Let me ask you this. And I know we've played these games before, Andy, but if somebody hands you $100 million.
Sure. No. This is my favorite part of the podcast. Go ahead.
Somebody gave you $100 million. How would you live the rest of your life?
I'd do podcasts with you.
From a yacht?
but probably yes. From my chalet in Colorado, or from my beach house on the Redneck Riviera on 30A in the Panhandle. I'd be in a different place every time. I'd have a penthouse in New York. By the way, I think I've spent most of it. I don't know. The way the real estate market is in most of I think I've just spent most of it. So sorry about that.
Is $60 million, so you're already out. And honestly,
so we're gonna have to keep doing podcasts because I gotta keep getting paid.
I don't know if $100 million is enough money actually to live the life that I would live. Because inflation, it's like 7%. Did you see that?
I saw that.
If I had that much money, I would have a yacht in the Mediterranean. Brit and I would no longer be a
billionaire
together.
For that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just change the question then from 100 million. Like if you had an unlimited amount of money, because I don't want somebody to be like, well, actually, the docking fees for a yacht are actually $100,000 an hour. It's like, okay, dude, like that's not what we're getting at. So I'm going to say 100 billion. It doesn't matter. Money is no object. Like I love my fiance with all of my heart and I hope that she would stay with me, but I would be on a yacht somewhere in the entire, in the Mediterranean. I'd be throwing lobsters at people. There'd be 100 women on the boat at all times. Hopefully Brit with me. There'd also be men on the boat to party with, and I would just be running the clock out in the most amazing way out in the ocean. I would watch college football.
I am just imagining you. Tarp, have you seen Goldfinger?
Tarp off 100% of the time. Never wearing a shirt ever again.
You would never have a shirt. That's what I was about to say. You would never ever be in a shirt. The chest hair would be going.
Oh my God.
There'd be a lot of gold, be a whole chest hair
gold
situation.
Chains.
Probably a gold medallion resting in the chest
right
hair.
Right in between the chest. Yep. Right between
You'd
the boots.
You'd probably become a Speedo guy because who's going to criticize you at that point?
Yeah. There's no such thing as an ugly, unattractive
throw them off the
person
yacht.
With that much money. Yeah. Okay. Come on my yacht and make fun of me for anything. You're off the yacht. You want to play that game? There's no such thing as an ugly rich person. Okay.
I'm just imagining you throwing lobsters at people.
You know, like fun coupons, throwing money in the air, fun coupons. And eating like whatever I want, never worrying about my weight ever again. And I don't care if I die too soon.
Ari, at a certain point, you would become Jabba the Hutt. Like you would be carried places on a litter.
But every single thing that I would eat would be amazing. Like if I want a Filet-O-Fish, I'm going to have a personal chef to make me the best Filet-O-Fish ever. Or if I want lobster, I'm going to eat it for breakfast. Like there'd be no, like every single meal I had would be chef prepared.
Jeeves, get me the Filet-O-Lobster.
Like it's like sometimes like I hear like Bill Gates drives a Ford Explorer and I just like want to strangle him. It's like you already won at life. Like I would be the most obnoxious, I would buy the dumbest stuff. I would just be like, you know what? We're going to run the clock out the right way.
So this reminds me, there was a conversation going back. I believe this happened probably about 20 years ago. And I will not name names because I don't want this person might hear it. I don't want to, we'll protect the innocent here, but there were a bunch of us talking and we're all in our very early 20s. None of us has any money. And we're saying, if you could get any vehicle you wanted, any vehicle at all, what would you drive? And so, I'm talking about like the most souped up Escalade ever, custom this, custom that, somebody else is thrown out.
So that's probably during the Pimp My Ride days, right?
Yeah. The nicest Porsche or a Lamborghini or Ferrari. And this other guy goes, Chevy Trailblazer. And we're like, no, you can have anything you want. And he's like, Chevy Trailblazer. And I'm like, but do you understand the point of the exercise here?
Yeah.
But it makes sense. Like it does. There are certain people that's what they need.
Can I throw my best friend under the bus? I'm not going to say his name, but one of my best friends in the entire world is a medical malpractice attorney. And this dude makes almost $1 million a year. Like, I mean, he is loaded. Like, this is my closest friend. I went to middle school with him.
Oh boy.
So I see. So, and this man lives in a one bedroom apartment and drives a 2011 Infiniti. And the only thing he cares about is buying stocks. So he doesn't buy material things. He just, all he's obsessed with is accumulating wealth. and accumulating wealth and accumulating wealth and never using it for anything. And I always joke with him. I said, well, I hope that you have a cool public library you're going to donate it to when you're gone.
Yeah.
Because I think it's insane to me. And like, but it's just a reminder that every single person gets joy from other things. So like I would enjoy
it's driving a Rolls Royce.
Yeah. I would drive a Rolls Royce Phantom everywhere I went, and I would never wear a shirt, and I would have a big gold chain.
So he wants to buy more shares of Apple. My son went through a luxury sports car kick, or it's like supercar kick. And we one day took him to the exotic car dealership in Orlando just so he could look at some of these cars up close. Cause we just happened to be driving by and we figured we'll stop in for a few minutes. And you know, we weren't going to spend too much time there. We don't want to be those looky-loos. But the guy there was so nice to us. He actually like let my kids sit in a Lamborghini. And but it was really interesting. I was asking tons of questions because I'm never going to be in the market for any of these vehicles.
Don't say
but
never.
We were looking at the Rolls Royces and the Bentleys and stuff. And the guy goes, yeah, the Rolls Royces are great, but they're not for you to drive. They're for someone to drive.
The two door ones in the convertible are.
No, he said basically the Bentley is the better driving experience. Like Bentleys are made for the owner to drive, and Rolls Royces are made for someone to drive you in.
Well, I did valet once in college, and I didn't know how to drive stick yet. And somebody brought in a Porsche 911. This car was like $200,000. And it was my first day on the job, and I stalled it in front of everybody. And that was my first day. And that was my first day doing valet at the JW Marriott Tucson Star Pass. And like everybody was like,
I've stayed there once.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like one of my college jobs, running valet there. And ever since then,
what was the nicest vehicle you ever got to park?
I drove a Bentley convertible. I don't know which exactly it was. And then at that point, my manager never let me drive a stick again. So like some of the Lamborghinis and stuff that came in, I wasn't able to drive.
Was it the Bentley with the suicide doors, or was it?
This was 2010, or 2009.
Okay, so it was different.
So it was a different era. But I drove a few Bentleys. I drove one Rolls Royce, and then there were a bunch of cool sports cars like Porsches and stuff. But if it was I really put myself in a bad position because I was never trusted to drive a stick again. So
But it's interesting though, because I don't know if this is my age showing or what, but when I got the truck I drive now, I was like, nope, I'm good.
But your truck is expensive, Andy.
It's nice. Yes, I'm not going to lie. But there are things that are much, much more expensive. But I wouldn't want them. Like, I want that. As soon as I started driving it, I was like, I'm good. If this is the only vehicle I drive again for the rest of my life, like if I own this thing for 20 years, I'm good.
Yeah, we're in a weird position, and it's funny that we're talking about this, and we're going on 15 minutes of non-football talk, and I love this podcast so much. I need to get a new car, and Brent has it in her mind that I have to have an SUV, because she's getting an SUV, and I want an SUV, or I want a car, but she thinks I need an SUV, so I'm probably going to get an SUV.
You're going to like an SUV better with young children, and I will say, we had a Honda Odyssey for 5 years when our kids were very young. Do not knock the minivan. It's a freaking movie theater on wheels.
I can't drive a minivan.
It's the best. Yes, you can.
I refuse, Ari. I can't.
You can. Drive the minivan, and then on the other side of it, get the, I don't know, the Maserati. Or the, maybe you'll be getting a Bentley by that point. Maybe this podcast will have taken off so much that I'll still have my truck because it's all I want. And you can get a Bentley.
You know what I really want, Andy? I want one
really
of those
want?
Ford. I want the new Bronco, but I want it to have the four doors and the rag top. But the ones that are nice are $100,000. So if I'm going to spend $100,000, I'm not buying a Ford.
Thank you.
So you know that's kind of the thing. But it's like the actual. If you want an SUV, you have two options. You've got $80,000 and up. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Jeep Grand Cherokee in the middle, which are about $50,000. New, and then everything else is like a Ford Edge for 23.
Is the Grand Wagoneer super expensive? 100 grand. Those look really cool.
Yeah, it's like a Suburban.
100 grand?
Oh, yeah, they started like 93.
Holy crap. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. All right.
A Jeep Grand Cherokee is 60 grand now. The two-door
Good
one.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's just because...
Let me just tell everybody, buy a Raptor in that case.
Yeah. I want a Raptor. I think my fiance is going to splurge because she just had a midlife crisis, I think. But we're going to try and go test drive some of those Mercedes GLEs with the digital dashboards that that self-park. And then that's going to like ruin my budget for the car that I'm going to get. So like she's going to get a nice car and I'm probably just going to end up with a Chevy Trailblazer. Chevy Trailblazer.
Let me tell you something else. As long as she's driving what she wants, your life's going to be better. So
that's right. You
just let that go. Let that happen. I did want to get back to our favorite games discussion because we were talking Michigan and Michigan State. And I want to know where this game, because in terms of competitiveness, this game wasn't very competitive. But where does it rank in terms of favorite games to watch or best games this season? Michigan, Ohio State. It's in the snow. Michigan wins. Super cathartic moment. Harbaugh breaks through. Like, I feel like that, unless you were an Ohio State fan, which of course, then it was awful for you. But for everybody else, in terms of just general viewership, like,
sure,
it was a pretty cool moment to see.
Absolutely, yeah. And of course, when you watch football games, you want to look at the games that, you know, reveal something new or that show you something new. You know, the problem with that game is that it wasn't overly entertaining because Michigan just kicked the crap out of Ohio State up front and ran the ball down their throat. And that's not always the funnest viewing experience, but it was certainly something new and something exciting. So for sure, I think that belongs on the list. I've got another one for you.
Okay.
And this one will never be remembered. In 5 years, nobody will ever talk about it again. Season opening weekend, Florida State versus Notre Dame overtime game.
Oh, it was awesome. You know, people will remember it because Brian Kelly butchered the John Robinson joke in the post-game interview. But yes, Mackenzie Milton comes in, throws some touchdowns.
Yep.
Like, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, and it was like at the time, if you put yourself in that moment, you're thinking to yourself, Notre Dame is awesome, and so is Florida State. Florida State's back. You almost felt...
And crowds are back. Like, that was the first time, like...
Primetime game.
First weekend we got to see full stadiums, and Doak Campbell's going crazy. So, yeah, don't tell Florida State what happened in the next couple of weeks. But at that moment, it was incredible. I think you're right. That was the one where, for me, because it was Labor Day night, it was the game everybody was watching, I basically remember thinking this season's going to be awesome.
Yep, we're back.
Because the fans are back. We're going to have real, genuine excitement. Let's go. And I got to say, I don't think the season disappointed. Did two superpowers from the SEC play for the national title? Yeah.
But we got a lot of new dishes.
Played a fun game. Yeah.
We got a lot of new things. I mean, we got a new Big Ten champ.
Yes.
Two first-time trips to the playoff, a group of five discussion that actually culminated in them making it.
Oklahoma's stranglehold on the Big 12 ended. Yep.
You know, there was a lot to see this year. And I think that by and large, the season was probably one of the more memorable ones of the last 5 years, if I had to like really think about that. Because you had some new and some old, and it culminated with the best team in the country winning it based on the unit that we talked about all year.
Yeah.
The defense.
I think you're right. It was a lot of fun. It was the year defense struck back. And I don't think that was a fluky thing either. I think defenses have finally gotten a little bit caught up. That they got caught so by surprise by the clock rules changing in 2008 and the up-tempo offenses. It basically everything changed so fast that the defenses couldn't really adjust schematically. I think now they've had enough time. And so you will see actual decent defense being played. It is possible to have a dominant defense again. So I think that's good for the game. I like the cycles where the offense is up.
The Georgia Clemson game was really good this year, don't you think?
It was,
I don't know.
I was entertained, but it was pretty ugly.
If you have two top 10 teams or two top five teams in the third or fourth quarter separated by a touchdown or less, it's entertaining to me. All I care about is two good teams playing and not knowing who's going to win and every play mattering, and that's entertainment. It doesn't have to be 55-48 for me to enjoy it.
Well, there were a lot of different ways to enjoy college football this year, because you can enjoy Georgia Clemson, you could also enjoy Wake Forest Army, and everything in between. So it was a wonderful season. Ari and I made some ridiculously stupid bets. I bet on Pitt a couple times. That tells you all you need to know. But I had a blast. We're going to keep going with this thing. Ari and I are going to keep talking. The digressions probably will get more frequent as the offseason goes on. So just be ready for that. And just imagine Ari shirtless, weighing twice as much as he does now, because he can afford every single piece of gourmet food on his yacht, being carried from one end of his yacht to another, just throwing lobsters at everyone.
And then when the boat docks, me getting off the boat and into my decked out Honda Odyssey.
Well, you'll be able to fit thanks to the sliding door.
Yep.
We'll talk to you later.